Thanks for that introduction. I thought the winter to spring thing was a wee bit pithy, but what I really wanted to say was it's a holy season, you know, and it's a great time, you know, to take a look inside ourselves. And Parker Palmer, who is a wonderful Quaker, oftentimes I would hear him say, "How then shall I live? How then shall I live?" And so. Anyhow, I'm Kevin O'Brien. I am not related to Melissa, although you never know. So, in the program, you have an insert that has a number of quotes, and you know, take a look at them sometime, if you will, and maybe find someone to speak with and talk about the quotes and what they may mean. This morning I may refer to a few, but the quotes are really, really, really powerful. And, you know, when I was listening to and reciting as well the opening blessing, there's some really, really wonderful lines in your blessings, you know. Oh, by the way, I'm a drifter. And what does that mean? I was part of the original UU congregation, and then I drifted away, and now I'm sort of drifting back. And I think sometimes you need to leave your home in order to know where your home is at. And so I am back. So the quiet strength that has always been within us. One of the quotes that you have, I think, is from Emerson, and he's describing, you know, what's behind us and what's in front of us is pale to what dwells within us. And that's a really provocative line. And the other thing that struck me this morning was I think it's a Chinese proverb. I think it goes something like this, that the mighty oak lies asleep within an acorn. So that's pretty good stuff, huh? I wish I could tell you I made it up, but I didn't. And then the other thing I wanted to say is I'm really grateful to Melissa and to Dan for the inspiration they give me. They just do. And Dan, when Dan was playing the song "One with the Water," I'm very big on metaphors. And if you just listen to Dan's song, you don't need to listen to me. Is that the one with the water is it's what it's about. I mean, the whole idea of an inward journey is to find your way. Is to find your way to the capacity to become one with the God spirit, the divine, however you may define things. And so one with the water, I mean, the imagery of that is just really beautiful. And so thank you, Dan. You know, I'm not a preacher, and I'm not an expert in anything. So I want to get that out of the way. And my comments this morning really are more like a memoir. In the 40 plus years that I had a chance to be a part of other people's lives, and I always wanted to be a companion more than anything. And I would speak with people about that at the front end. They said, I just want to be your companion. I don't want you to be alone when you're making passage through difficult times. Because I will promise you, the most healing thing on the planet is connecting at a mystical level and to be vulnerable. The most powerful experiences I've had in terms of relationships with anybody is that when they're vulnerable. Sort of in psychology, you learn about this thing called ego, and ego is basically a compilation of the fears you have in your life. You're afraid, and so you come up with all these strategies to distract yourself from the pain. But one of the great ironies in our life is that when you are hurting, and when two people are hurting together, there's a mystical experience that has a cellular impact. And what that means is that in our bodies, there are a zillion cells. And in each year, each of your cells dies off. But before it dies, it hands off its memory to another cell. And so, you know, if you like math, there's a good chance if you have a kid, their kid's going to like math. You know, if you like to play guitar, there's a good chance. It's carried in the DNA. And so what happens when you are fully vulnerable with another human being, when you are present? Now, present is a mystical experience. It's not a social one. It's not psychological. It's mystical. And what happens in that level of presence, the cells that hold our wounds begin to release the wound. And we are one with the water. Right, Dan? That's how it happens. So I'll share with you, mostly it's a memoir. A couple, it may have been a month or two ago, Melissa spoke about this collaboration between the community and the journey inward. It's a collaborative experience, and that and probably the safest place to do the inward journey is in with the context of a community. You need both. But in so many ways, there's an old gospel song, you got to walk that valley, you got to walk it by yourself. Ain't nobody here can walk it for you. And that's true. But in the context of community, it's a wee bit less scary. Okay, so the inward journey. In the world's great religious traditions, there really is a core belief in each of them that there's something very, very special that dwells within us. You know, it's your Christ consciousness, your Buddha nature, the light within, your nature. And Jeff, Shema? Yeah, from the Jewish tradition. And so the core belief is that there is something within each of us that is a slice of whatever it is that is greater than us. And the inward journey, the spiritual life, is for each of us to connect the God self, the light within, with the greater self. And that's the spiritual life, is for that connection to be made. And it's a hard connection to make. It's a very hard connection to make. You know, when we are born into this life, the divine is already there. It's already there, you know. But what happens is that we are fundamentally sensory people. We're born into this world to sense the world, to feel the world, to be of the feminine, and not to think the world. If you ever held a baby, you hold the baby and the baby is navigating the world in a sensory way. So that's how we are born into this world, as sensory feeling beings and built to navigate the world by what we feel and what we sense rather than what we think. Let me just do a pause. I meant to say this earlier. I'm a concept guy, you know, and in my world of work, I would go through these kinds of opportunities to speak with people, but I speak in concepts. And then on occasion, if I'm sitting with somebody who is a detail person, at the end of my pontifications, they would say to me, okay, what do I do? And I said, I don't know what you do, you know, and is that you got to find your own path. You got to find your own way. Carl Jung, who was a wonderful Swiss psychiatrist, you know, he said that basically you have to find your own path, and if there are no obstacles on your path, then you're on somebody else's path. And Thomas Merton essentially said the same thing, and I think it's one of the quotes you have, is that Thomas Merton, who was a mystic and a Trappist monk, and one of the wonderful things he said, if you find God easily, then it's probably not God that you found. And so that validates and affirms, for me it does, you know, is that when it starts to get hard, when it hurts, you're probably getting closer to the God spirit, to the divine, than you think. But it's hard. It's a hard thing to do. In ancient Greece, I'll share with you a myth that they had. And, you know, this is 1,000, 2,000, I don't know, years old. And it's called the Procrustes myth. And in ancient Greece, I mean, and for me, the comforting thing is that this is not new material. You know, this is not new material. So in ancient Greece, all of Greece wanted to go live in Athens. And in Athens, it's where the art was, it was where education was, the beautiful people. All the good stuff was in Athens. But in order to get into Athens, you had to go through this gate. And standing out in front of the gate was this fellow Procrustes. And Procrustes had a bed. And so as there was a big line of people wanting to get into to Athens, but they had to get on this bed first. And so you get on the bed, and Procrustes was there. And if you were too tall, for the bed, he'd cut off part of your limbs so that you would fit the bed perfectly. If you were too short, he would stretch you until you fit the bed perfectly. Now, that may be a little unsettling characterization, but we've all been on that bed. We have all been on that bed. Now, remember, we were born into this sensory capacity. I mean, that's our divinity, okay? We're already there. But what happens is that because of culture and because of life circumstances, we get separated from our divinity. Our divinity is not gone, but we get separated from it. And that the emphasis, the culture, is to become thinkers. You know, in order to navigate your way through culture, is that we needed to be thinkers. And the older we got, the more that was reinforced in our world, is to think. And the more that was reinforced, the further we got away from our divinity. And, you know, the T.S. Eliot quote, he says, well, we must return to our spirit and know it for the first time. Return to our spirit and know it for the first time. So I want to just tell you this, is that when I was a kid, 8 years old or so, my father used to take me into inner city Albany on a quite regular basis. And he would go, he'd be dressed up with his fedora and his long coat, and he would bring me to the inner city of Albany, which was a community of beautiful people who whose economic lives were difficult, and who, by virtue of race, were put in one part of Albany. But my father would take me down, and we'd bring food and clothes. I'm 8 years old, and there were no food pantries, there were no thrift shops, and we would go down, and we would do that a lot. And my father taught me the golden rule. He never said it. He never said it. But he was teaching me the golden rule. And for all the things that I have done in my life, I really tried to bring the golden rule with me. I mean, there were plenty of crazy periods, but I never sort of lost sight of the golden rule. And I thought that the golden rule was what spiritual life was, the golden rule. But I learned that it was a big part of it, but it wasn't it. In the early 90s, I used to go out with rescue squads in the Adirondacks and in Northern Washington County. And Dan would probably know this, I'm sure he does, is that the rescue squads in the Adirondacks, a lot of them were like 18 years old because it was a rite of passage, you know, to join the volunteer fire department or the rescue squad. And I would go out with these folks to really difficult places, very, very difficult. And I would go back to the squad house with them and sit with them. And they felt safer because there was a mental health professional in the room. But I promise you, there was nothing that I could do other than to sort of be present, you know, to be present. And in the fire and rescue world, what you do when you're on your way to a difficult scene, and with the rescue squad, they never really knew what they were walking into. They just didn't know. And so they would get into what they call automatic pilot, which is they would separate themselves from their emotional selves so they could go in and they could get the job done. And I mean, these courageous, caring human beings, they would go into automatic pilot, but oftentimes they couldn't come back. Once you get into automatic pilot, it's hard to come back. So on one particular call, it was up north, deep in the Adirondacks. I got the call, and two 16-year-old girls were killed in a car accident. These two 16-year-old girls were coming back from high school, and they hit black ice, and they slid into a tree, and they died on the spot. And after that accident, I got to know the families a little bit, and particularly the fathers. Now these fathers, these two generational Adirondack guys, tough as could be. I mean, they could drop a 100-foot white pine, no problem. You know, they could take a Chevy 350 out of their pickup truck, take it out and put it back together. But to ask them to sort of go to that hurting place, ooh, that was a hard one. It was a hard one. And so they worked real hard to do the automatic pilot thing, you know, but it really wasn't working. I mean, just imagine, and maybe some of the room here know that experience, the ache in their hearts. And one of the fathers actually went to the graveyard, and he dug his daughter's grave with his backhoe. And, you know, it was that experience that I realized in life the golden rule wasn't enough. It just wasn't enough. You know, and I thought the golden rule, I was in good shape. And so in sitting with these fathers and there was nothing in my playbook at all, nothing, you know, and I would just sit with them. You know, psychology, I didn't think that was going to be very useful. Actually, I thought it would be arrogant to try to bring that into the room. So 2 weeks later, I found myself in New York City, and I was a part of this organization, this group, and they were nationally known, high-end mental health people, psychiatrists, psychologists, nurses, and each of these people. I mean, they're from all over. I mean, these are these people that write books. And they were basically there together because they felt that psychology had thrown out the most important thing in the healing experience, and that was the spirituality and the mystical. That psychology in those days was very busy trying to look like science, because, you know, that's, if you wanted to get paid for anything, you had to have evidence-based stuff and all that nonsense. And so these folks got together and they said, listen, we got to bring back spirituality and the mystical. And it's interesting that the word psychology actually comes from the Greek word psyche, which means soul. But they had taken the spiritual and the mystical out of it. And so I felt like I had permission. I had permission to be able to go back and to visit with people and go beyond the bounds of psychology and really into the mystical. That if I could get over myself and I could sit with people and my ego was somewhere else, that would be the very, very best thing I could do. Just be with him. Because what happens, it does become mystical. And you can't fill out some Department of Health form that evidences that. You just can't. And in my world, I gave everybody the same diagnosis. Everybody, you know, everybody had an adjustment disorder with mixed emotional features, you know, and I just wanted to get that out of the way so I could sort of create an experience in a way that we were both vulnerable, because I think the divine dwells in our vulnerability. That's where the divine lives. And so I had permission from these folks down in New York City to come back to the Adirondacks and try to be with people differently. And I hope I was a good companion. I think I was a good student. So I just want to tell you a little bit about the differences between the traditional psychological model and the psycho-spiritual, which brings in the mystical and the spiritual. And the spiritual work actually begins with psychology. Psychology is very, very good at helping us to identify patterns in our life, identify events or situations that have left us with some wound of sort. But traditional psychology is born out of pathology. Something's wrong. The psycho-spiritual model is something's right. Now, that's not to dismiss the degree of difficulty and anguish we suffer as human beings. Viktor Frankl, who's one of your quotes, if there is a meaning in life, there must be a meaning in suffering. And in our world, we have, through culture, we have stayed away from that. We have stayed away from suffering. And I suppose if I were the superintendent of schools, one of the first courses I'd put in there is teach people how to suffer. Teach people how to be depressed. You know, just as a sidebar, the quotes that you have in your insert, every last one of those people suffered with depression their whole life. Their whole life. And so in the spiritual model, we see depression much like, and I do want to qualify, there are debilitating forms of depression. But depression in the indigenous cultures, oftentimes depression was known as time of the bear. Time of the bear. You would go inside of yourself. And so it wasn't, you weren't diagnosed. You know, you just knew. You go inside of yourself. You go inside of yourself. So that would be one of the major components of a spiritual model. And in the spiritual model, there was a core teaching that, as difficult as it is, it's all part of the story that may move us to the divine. It may move us there. You know, it may, in fact, begin to sort of unravel the madness of having been on Procuste's bed. You sort of need to fall apart and put yourself together by yourself. And the other thing, and I might get myself in trouble, which is nothing new, about letting go. And so often in the self-help books or wherever you are, is that they encourage you to let go. And I would submit to you, dear friends, hopefully, that you can't let go of every wound. You can't. Our wounds become embedded in the cells. And sometimes the wounds that we're trying to let go of, and this is another topic, are the wounds of our ancestors. So in my visiting with people, and oftentimes I would be the last stop, people who have worked really, really hard at letting go of stuff. And all I needed to say was, just hold it differently. Let the wound be your teacher. Let the wound be your teacher. And so the feeling of inadequacy or shame because I couldn't let go of the wound becomes empowering. Aha. So it now is my teacher. And again, I don't want to minimize how hard it gets. Yeah, okay? So essentially the difference between a spiritual model and the more traditional, and you need both. You need both because you need the insight piece and you need the language of psychology. But to get back to the divine, it needs to be reframed a bit. So there are different maps sort of out there to help us in this journey inward so that we may return to our spirit and know it for the first time. A couple of times, Joseph Campbell has been mentioned here, you know, the hero's journey. Another example, again, and this is ancient, thousands of years old, it comes from the shamanic teachings of Central and South America. And it starts with, and all these are really kind of like a circle, is you must shed the skin of the serpent. You must shed the skin of the serpent. And that's essentially saying is that you need to undo what has happened on Procuste's bed. And you may or may not know this, but before whatever garden it was that Eve and Adam were in the apple, the serpent for thousands of years represented healing. And if you, maybe at a pharmacy or a doctor's office, you'll see a staff with a serpent wrapped around it. That's where that comes from. So the serpent represented healing. So there are these maps. The one map I'll share with you quickly, John O'Donohue, who is a wonderful Irish theologian, poet, he, in a very gentle way, he talked about the spirit within was much like a lantern that had four glass panels on it, and the panels had become full of soot. And you couldn't see the light that was inside of it. And so the work, the spiritual life, is to gently and with patience and courage is to wipe off the panels of the lantern so the light can illuminate once again. Spiritual metaphor, it gets hard. You get frustrated, you want to give up. spiritual metaphor, and nature is one of the most powerful. When I was walking over here, actually with spiritual metaphor, you can kind of go crazy with it, but I was walking over here and I was looking at this big maple tree, all the leaves gone, and I was noticing all the crooked limbs. And I was just imagining that, you know, we have sort of this public self. We have this self that we try to portray and try to hide some of the parts of ourselves that we don't want to be seen. But that tree reminded me that that tree could not be a tree without all those crooked limbs. And so it validates, it affirms, and reminds me that whatever my version of the crooked limbs are, it helps hold me up. So I will finish up with a couple of things here. Is that, when I was in the Adirondacks doing my thing, I would, actually it started with the fathers of the two girls that died. And I, when you do your stone thing, if you could remember these two girls, I know their names, I never saw their faces, but Abraham Lincoln at Gettysburg, he talked about a band of witnesses that are always keeping an eye on us. I know that these girls are keeping an eye on me, because I'm taking their story, and it's now yours. You can have it, these two beautiful girls. So I would take groups of men, 20 at a time, and the oldest was in their 80s, and the youngest may have been in their 40s. So 20 men into the woods, tough guys, you know, like Eric Lawson, you know, they all had flannel shirts. And yeah, they're great. I love these guys. I love these guys. So we'd go in, and one of the things that we would do is that we would hike a mountain, and we'd hike it in silence and ask each of the men, and I did it around, I think, 300 of these guys, just to pick up something from the forest floor and bring it to the top of the mountain. We'd sit in a circle, and we would ask each of the guys to put it in whatever they picked up. And, you know, rocks, limbs, acorns, and they would explain how that sort of signified some part of their life. And one guy, he was quiet just about the whole time, 3 days that we're in the woods, and he put in a wintergreen leaf, and he simply said, "The essence of the wintergreen leaf is only known when you crush it." And I was just beautiful. I'm getting goosebumps just remembering it. I can see it. And so our essence is only revealed when we're crushed, when we're vulnerable. So how does the innerward journey begin? I think in three ways. I think Melissa has mentioned a couple of times that it starts in the when something really painful happens in our life, and we just don't know where to go with it, and so that's, again, in psychology talk, your ego just doesn't work anymore. You can't rationalize. You can't, you know, project. You can't, whatever it is. You keep grabbing onto something. Denial, it doesn't work, and so you are crushed. The other way is, another way is, there was this guy Maslow who he did this thing called human behaviorism, right, Bev? I mean, I think that's what he called it. But essentially, he thought of our lives in like a pyramid, and you start at the bottom, and at the bottom, it's about safety and achievement and belonging and all this other stuff. But he initially said it's about self-actualization. And then he backpedaled and he said, no, I got that wrong. It's about spirituality. It's about spirituality. So it's out there. And then the third way, and I thought of this yesterday during No Kings, is social disorder. Is that when the world around you is so much in disarray that you do what you can do on the social end of it, but you can end up asking the very, very, very same questions that you would ask when you're crushed or with Maslow. You would ask yourself, what is the meaning of life? What is the meaning of my life? And where is God in all of this? So the same questions, are arisen under different circumstances. It's thank you for listening. Thanks. You know, it's good for me. It's good for me to get out of my head. And I also know, and I will, I'll say this, is that I know I'm a concept guy. I already gave you that excuse. Is that, but I know people process information differently. And there may be something I said that you are processing and you want to get your arms around it a little bit more. And I understand that. It may take a day or two or a week or whatever. But if there's something out there that you wanted to talk to me about or, argue with me, I'm in. So here's to all of us. And we must remember what we have forgotten. We must remember what we have forgotten.